KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. Welcome to the Kurt Fish Anderson Memorial Beet Farm. I'm Bruce the Moose, curator of tonight's disjointed collection of fish stories from Dave Anderson, Doug Lindahl, and Kathy Lindahl, plus a little related music. The finale will be Big Dave's interview of fish from October of 2015, followed by a bit of fish-related music. We'll start with an abbreviated reading of Fish's obituary by Chris Belfield.
To honor the passing of loved ones, Kurt Fish E. Anderson, January 17, 1963, December 15, 2024. Heaven got a lot more musical on Sunday, December 15th. After years of fighting like a fish, our son, brother, uncle, and friend Kurt lost his long battle with cancer. Although not jazzed about leaving, he was comfortable and at peace, surrounded by loved ones. Kurt's love of music was passed down from his mother, and Fish took it to the next level. His love of drums and drumming progressed into a profession. He was in countless bands, Trick Whisper, The Cervantes, Fish and the Fins, The Hitchhikers, Hopi's Turtle, and Raging Country, to name a few. Kurt also worked with artists like Cheap Trick, B.B. King, and Nelly. Racing was in Kurt's blood. He was either at a track or wearing gear. He loved all things racing, but drag racing held a special place in his heart. He traveled to many local and national races over the years. A celebration of life will be held on January 11, 2025 at the American Legion in Two Harbors at 3 p.m., followed by a night filled with music and friends. In lieu of flowers, please consider honoring Kurt Anderson's legacy by donating to the Two Harbors High School Music Program. In the immortal words of Kurt, peace, love, and Bobby Sherman.
I'm Dave Anderson. Lonesome Dave from Brindy Lake.
You're supposedly a famous radio producer from a giant radio station somewhere in the past.
Yeah. I was actually in charge of the antenna. That was my claim to fame. Getting in and out of the ground every day. So, okay, this is about Fishy. And about, I don't know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I was in Duluth. I was married at the time, and my wife and I were leaving Duluth or the area and coming home for some reason. I live in Brimson. And we stopped at a bar. I can't think of the name of the bar. And as we went in and said, and we're going to have a drink on the way home, is what it was. And across the bar was a horseshoe bar, and across the bar there sits Fishy. And I nodded at him, and he nodded at me. And in the course of 15 or 20 minutes, he'd move around, he'd look at me, and every time I'd look back at him, he'd look away. And I couldn't figure out why he was doing that. And it was just something was up. And he was cold sober, as far as I could tell. Finally, he comes around to the bar. And he comes up to me, and he's right alongside of me, and he said, I need to talk to you. And I said, what? And he said, do you remember the time when I was like 11 years old and I came down to your mother's place in Knife River and you and your son were playing guitar? I said, no, I really don't. I said, it wasn't unusual that I'd have a guitar in my hands. I usually did, and I still do. You know, I still play a lot. And he said, well, I sat there and watched you two. And he said, Kurt and I are the same age. They're both named Kurt. And he said, I was mesmerized. And he said, I went home, and he said, on my bicycle, and I just about went in the ditch. And he said, I decided that that was what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, that I wanted to be a musician. He said, I was so impressed with what you did that that's what I did. And I bought my first set of drums. And I was floored. I had no idea. But he said that I was the reason that he got into music, or that situation that he saw us playing in is why he got into music.
Doug Lindahl is my name, and I played with Fish forever, and we've been just best friends. And I've spent countless hours discussing music and driving and playing and recording with him, and I have nothing but I'm going to miss him, and I'm glad we can talk about him. I've met Fish, I suppose, around third or fourth grade, but you know, we weren't close at that time. But we both grew up in musical environments, and you know, years later, when I started connecting with, must have been, you know, eighth grade or ninth, that we would get back to school and talk about the Midnight Special, you know, and how important that was for both of us. And Casey Kasem's Top 40 on Saturday mornings, we would listen to that, and then we would talk about it in school. So, I mean, he's always said that he was a listener before he was a player. And I would agree with that for myself, too. We were, you know, we hadn't picked up instruments at that time, but we were, you know, it was so important to us just to listen. And we would just, you know, he was so passionate about, you know, music in general. You know, he'd always say that his alarm clock going to school when he was very young, well, his mother would always play records. That was his alarm clock. And it would be a different record every morning for school. So it'd be, and he'd always mention what it'd be. It'd be Elvis or Simon and Garfunkel or anything. But that was his alarm clock. Every day he woke up to music. And of course, he would say that every now and then his mom would slip in one of his older brother's records. It'd be Uriah Heep or, you know, whatever they had, Deep Purple or whatever. But that's how he woke up every day. So anyway. Midnight Special for him was, you know, he was really into the course. He knew which direction he was going to go, I think, it's as far as what instrument he loved. And it was the drummer. He was, you know, he was attracted to that right away. And, you know, we would discuss music. And then as we got older, we picked up instruments and inevitably started to play down at his mother's house, which I feel sorry for what she had to listen to, because we were down in their basement, just me and him, and we would play. He loved long finishes, you know, the end of a song. So literally we'd play a quarter of a song, but then have a 15-minute finish of just noise. Just solid noise. And I felt sorry for his poor mom upstairs. But yeah, that's, you know, and after that we started, you know, playing the clubs and everything. And I think I played 50 years with him all together. Many, many, many thousands of miles logged on with him in the middle of the night. And
what were the names of the bands you were in with?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, there was Fish in the Fins was one, and I don't know, I can't even remember the high school band, but it was called Destiny or something, I don't remember. Then there was one, I don't even know if I could say it on air, but it was, we lived in the cities for a year, and we were playing hard rock then, just for about a year, but that
did it end with the Biscuits?
No, he was on his own. He stayed down there later, and yeah, he was with the Biscuits, but this one was called Balls, but it was BALZ. Oh, yeah. we never made any money at all, not a dime, but we would play for free just to open up for the big shots down there in those days, and so that was a lot of fun, you know. Yeah, he stayed down there, and he was with a bands down there, and I came back home here, and I went to school. And then when he came back, we started playing again up here, so.
I knew his dad before, it was before he was born. I was, when I was 14 or 15, I had a friend that bought a drum set, and he had him set up, and we set him up in my bedroom. He didn't have room for him at his place, and my stepfather was, he hated musicians, long-haired weirdos, is what we, and he would have destroyed them if they'd have been mine, but I got him convinced that these are not mine, they belong to my friend, and they're just sitting here. And of course, he was a salesman, so he was gone during the week and just home on the weekends, and the minute he left, I'd be sitting at the drum set. So I started on drums, and his dad, Fishy's dad, Ray Anderson, whom I knew, had bought a new Fender Stratocaster guitar, and he was the only one I knew at the time with a new guitar, and he was older than me, but he would come down and sit in with us kids. You know, we had a couple of guitars and the drums, and every time he'd come down, it would be, I got one here called a little Tennessee flat top box, and that was actually the only song that he could play part of, and he would get into like three or four verses of it and then quit. and say, well, I got to go. And that would be, that was the end of that. And I don't think he ever did get progressed beyond those three verses of that song. That was it. But, and I think Fishy sold that guitar here not too long ago and got a nice chunk of money for it.
Yeah, it was about, I suppose, 3 years ago he did sell it. And I used to, back in the day, I played that guitar too. I think that was part of the big finishes in their basement. He would let me play that guitar. It was just beautiful, and it played so nice. It was a 1957 Sunburst Stratocaster, and he had an old, I think it was a Yamaha amp. And I was fortunate enough to get to play that guitar. Very nice guitar.
57 would have been right about the time that we were doing that stuff in the back room that he was playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ray, he'd be upstairs too, sitting in his chair while I was down there wrecking his guitar. I think the first year we played, back in, I think in 89 or 1988, we were signed by a music agency in Minneapolis, which is, you know, now at my age, it was the worst thing we could have ever done. But they had us working all the time. I think we played over 200 nights in 1 year. We were doing six-nighters and five-nighters week after week, and it ran us ragged. Once it was a five-year contract, so once we finally got out of that, it was funner to play because there wasn't so much. You know, we were just driving all the time. But when people talk about the megastorm, Fish and I drove home in the megastorm and a couple other bandmates that night from, I think it was Barron, Wisconsin, and it was a Thursday night. A Halloween party, and we were playing down there. I think it might have been a bowling alley, but we drove home that night, and we couldn't see the front of the car all the way from Barron to Superior. Like, honestly, we couldn't even stop. People they talk about that storm, and we lived it. We were scared. We couldn't see a thing. Nothing. We just kept driving until it became daylight and we were in Superior. It was crazy. But yeah, we drove home in that storm.
Where'd you end up?
About a block away from my dad's house where the car finally hit a snowbank and was stuck. And I had to work that day too. And I did. I went to work.
Well,
and we put flags around the car so the plow wouldn't hit it because it was completely buried.
I listened a little bit to the interview that Big Dave did with Fish back in the day. That's 8 years ago now, probably something like that. And Fish declined to explain on why he was known as Fish. And perhaps there's some ugly story behind it.
I could be wrong, but I'm fairly sure that this is how he got that name. It was gym class way back in probably the grade school, and he couldn't swim. And the teacher said, get in the pool, we'll have you swimming like a fish in no time. And I think it came from that. I'm pretty sure that's where it came from.
I thought maybe it was from Knife River, because we were, you know, in those days, you either worked for the railroad or you worked on the lake pulling nets, and you were involved in fish all the time. And we're all the jokes when we go to high school or to school, it would be about, you know, oh, smell like fish, you know. The first set of drums that Fishy ever sat at was my drums, and I had given them to my son Kurt. I was on the road working all over the country, and I said, I can't be lugging these around. I think I was working in North Dakota then, and my son was, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old, and I said, take these, put them in your bedroom. Don't let people take pieces of them. Don't leave them. Don't let them go. Because I had bought them. I was playing in a nightclub in Sioux Falls, a supper club. I played six nights a week. I played there for a year with a jazz trio. And these are a real nice set of slinger ones that I'd bought, you know, hand-picked cymbals and all that. And so my son had them set up in his bedroom. And that's where the first time Fishy set at a real kit. And he told me this. I didn't know that was the first drums he'd ever played. Mm. And later on, I came up here. I'd bought that property up in Brimson in 1979 and moved up there. And I was playing over at Hugo's. I was playing guitar, and I had taught my son how to play guitar, so we were both playing. And Fishy runs into us, and he said, I got this. I got a new set of drums, his first set of drums that he'd bought. And he was taking lessons, and he was just jabbering like crazy at me. And I said, well, listen, I got this gig. I'm playing over Hugo's. I'm playing Saturday. You want to sit in? Oh, wow. You know, his first job as a drummer. And this was before Hugo's even had their extension on, where they actually have the bands now. It was just a tiny little bar then. And we were jammed by the jukebox. And I think Electric Jim was the guy that was singing and playing the guitar. And it was Kurt, and my son Kurt, and myself. And then Fishy on drums. And he had this huge set of drums that took up most of the space. His style of drumming in those days was just nothing but a steady rock beat. Mm-hmm. And we were playing this old country, and it didn't really fit. And at the bar, there was a fellow that was sitting there that I knew, and I can't remember his first name. I believe it was Highland was his last name. And he was, I guess, I don't know if you can say blind anymore, but he was sightless. He could not see anything. And he had been since birth, I think. And he was sitting at the bar drinking a beer, and the place was packed and jumping, and we were playing and going like crazy. The dance floor was going, and this guy turns around, and he's got this beer in his hand, and he's got his eyes open. Of course, he's looking at the ceiling because he can't see anything, and he's headed towards the music, and he's taking these weird steps as he's coming. It looks like an old movie or something as he was walking towards us through the crowd of dancers, and he's kind of bouncing off of them, and they're getting out of the way to let him go by, and he comes up, and he's coming right at us. And I'm playing, I'm looking at him going, what is he doing? And like I said, he had a bottle of beer in his hand, and he walked right past the singer, who moved out of the way thinking that he was, you know, after something, going to bring in somebody a beer or something. And what he was after was Fishy. Thought that was the devil's music, that drumming.
Oh, no.
And he's going after Fishy, and Fishy comes up out of the drums, sees the guy after him. See, we're all watching the guy come at us, but anyway, he comes up with his drumsticks. And he starts playing, just slapping a guy in the forehead with his drumsticks. Pap, 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 pap. And you could hear it, you know, just pap, 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 pap. And the guy's just twisting his head, and he reached out and he got a hold of Fishy with his left arm, pulled his head in, and he takes the beer bottle and smashes it against his head. And of course, then all hell breaks loose. I jumped up and I said, you know, if you weren't blind, I'd kick your ass. And I had him by the arm, and I was wanting to hit him. And Hugo comes running in, that owned the bar at the time, grabbed the guy, and he pulled him out, and he shoved him out the door and said, get out of here. And he was a regular. He'd been there for, you know, around that area for 30 or 40 years. But and Fishy runs over, and he had brought his parents and his brothers and sisters, and they were sitting in a booth, seeing his debut playing, and here he is with his blood running down the side of his head from this. The guy actually smashed a beer bottle right on the side of his head, which is probably a good place to hit Fishy because it didn't hurt him. So, but he was bleeding, and he was going, I'm going to sue. I'll sue. I'm going to sue. And then, of course, by the time he starts that, I started laughing because it was hilarious. But it wasn't at the time. But later on, I laughed. And I tried not to laugh when he was going through his hysterics. But that was my second big Fishy story.
I think I remember that. I remember him talking about that from back then.
Yeah.
That rings a bell.
Yeah, his first music critic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I talking about drums and drummers, it reminded me of the joke that may or may not make the final cut of the program, but what do you call a guy who likes to hang out with musicians?
Oh, drummer.
Back to Fish. During COVID, we recorded some songs that we wrote down in Duluth. I think it was at Midwest Sound there at Travis's place, and Travis did it. He recorded us, and I think there may be three or four of them on there, and it never was completed, but the drums are completed, so I have two friends that want to make this happen in honor of Fish, and one's Tony Price. He's a fantastic singer, musician, and he wants to sing on it. And Bart Porter from Duluth has a studio, so this could get done, and it would be in honor of Fish. So I think it's going to happen. you got some pretty motivated individuals that really want to help and get it done, so.
Be nice.
The songs, all they need is at least three or four of them right now. All they need is a singer, and those can be done, so.
Thank you.
I'm Kathy Lindahl, married to Doug, and I met Kurt, well, must have been back in 1994 when we first started dating, and I thought he was a really interesting, funny guy, and we went on a lot of little road trips and saw different bands, and I saw how much fun Doug was having with Fish and all of his buddies and the band, and I was kind of a groupie, like to get out there and dance and watch the guys play. And Doug and Fish were very good friends, and Fish was best man at our wedding, so that was really pretty funny, too, you know, because he's not really ever serious. And at the reception, you know, the best man usually says a toast, and it's usually real sweet and, you know, wishing you well and all that sort of thing. Well, not Fish, you know. He raised up his glass and said something like, why would a beautician marry a balding man, you know? And everybody just started laughing, and I kept waiting, is he going to say something more, or is this, you know, is it, oh, nope, nope. That's it.
Thanks, Fish.
Thanks. That just kind of said it all, so he was so funny.
One of the things later on, after Fish was sick or whatever, what he really, really loved was our class, or us guys who played together 45 years ago, got back together again. And that would be John Lauder and Tony Price and Dave Stanko. And that was a guy from the cities that Tony knew. But we got together and we played Selman. A few times at the Landing.
Mike Selman, too.
Oh, and Mike Selman. And we had a lot of fun. It was really nice to see these guys after all these years. And Fish was just having a ball with it, and he was really thankful this happened, and we all were. So that was really nice this happened. So, yeah, something that Kurt and I got to warm up for lots of bands, more than I can remember right now, from Patti Loveless to Nazareth. But the one that was most important for him and myself was we warmed up for Cheap Trick in the Duluth Arena. Fish and I both saw Cheap Trick together, I think it was 35 or 36 times we had seen them live. Finally, we got to meet them and open up for them. And some guys from Duluth made this happen. I have nothing but respect for those guys. And it was wonderful. I mean, I could have, you know, it was meeting Robin Zander and Rick Nielsen for him was, it was the zenith. It was, you couldn't be any happier after that. And that was around 1990 or 91. And he talked about that continually all the way till right now. It was the high point in his life, and I was there with him. So that was absolutely great. Got to meet him after we played, and they were real nice and friendly. And Robin Zander, that guy's made me cry a ton of tears because I just respect him and love his voice so much. And he just said, how'd it go? How'd it go? And he was so friendly. And I just thought, man, this is the coolest thing ever. But I got to share that experience with Fish. Well, I'll never forget that. I told Rick Nielsen, you have no idea I told him how many times we've seen him. And he said, at that time, I think it was like 26 times. I think it's, we've seen you guys 26 times, and he said, that's 25 times too many, you know, so. Oh, one story Fish used to love to talk about was we were coming home from the range one night, and it was a blinding snowstorm, and I think we were a couple miles south of Hugo's, you couldn't see the front of the car. We were following another bandmate, and the flakes were coming out. It was just crazy how hard it was snowing, and all of a sudden the guy in front stopped, and he said, I think I seen feet sticking out of a snowbank. And so we didn't see it, and And so he said, back up. So we both backed up, and he gets out of his car and he runs over there, and there were feet sticking out of the snowbank. He pulls his feet out on the highway. And yeah, there was a guy in the snowbank that was walking. He crashed his car and he was walking, and we pulled him. Dave pulled him out onto the highway, and we gave him a ride back to town. And all's well that ends well. But yeah, that was one story. And oh, there were so many of them, so many. We were coming home one night, and the wheel flew off the van. We were all in it, just flew off. Oh, and that was down in Ironwood, Hurley. We were coming back from Hurley. Yeah, we got about 5 miles up the highway, and tire falls off. Yeah, man, we didn't have a jack, of course. In the winter.
Yeah, back in Car Talk, they had the song, "You Picked a Fine Time to Leave Me, Loose Wheel."
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember one time coming home through Brimpson again, and there's a, by Hypenins, I think it was, there's a little gully in the road there.
Yep.
Yeah, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we had two cars coming back, and I was the guy in the first car I was driving, and came over the hill, and there was a car or a truck parked right there and right in the lane with no lights on or anything, just there. And I didn't see it until it was like the last minute. And I missed it, went around it. You know, it was a close call, but the car behind us said that had we not stopped, they would have hit him at 55 miles an hour. We ran right into him because you couldn't see it at all. And that was back when I could see at night, but yeah, it was really, it was black car too, a black truck. So you couldn't see it at all. You know, there were lots of those kind of stories that Fish and I would go through. And, you know, we'd always say, how much longer are we going to do this? He'd say, how much longer can we do this? And, you know, he'd say, I don't know. You know, they drop them off and go home and do it again the next weekend. And Fish, he had so much. What I loved about him the most was his passion for music never stopped, ever. Even when, you know, we would always discuss, you know, how lucky we were to have grown up in the 70s. There was so much music in those days. And you know, every time you walk into music land where there were records, you know, there was something new from Boston or something new from Aerosmith or Foghat or it was just endless, and we were lucky to have that. Well, all these years later, you know, it all disappeared. But he still searched deep. He dug deep, and he found great songs. He had to dig for them, but he found them. And as soon as he'd get one, he'd be on the phone. He'd say, I got to come up. I got to play you. You're not going to believe what I found. And he'd be just as passionate today as he was when he was a teenager. And I always respected that. I just thought, I just respect someone who could just hold that thrill their whole life. And he did. And that was great. He'd always, you know, he'd have three or four songs that he couldn't wait to play for me. And we'd sit in the garage by a fire and we'd listen to that stuff. It was great.
He liked playing it to Alyssa, too.
And Alyssa, my daughter, he'd play her great songs, and you know, and she loved his taste. So, you know, later we'd be in her car, and she'd be playing that song too. She loved it so much that she'd have it in her car. So I thought, well, that was great. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things Fish loved so much just recently is that my dad has started to call me Lenny. That's just what he calls me, you know, Lenny. So Fish could not get enough of that. He would call me on the phone just to call me Lenny. He would laugh and laugh and laugh. Yep, Lenny.
He had an infectious giggle.
Yeah.
He liked a cocktail, too. And when he was drinking and that giggle came on him, he'd giggle and rock around on a bar stool back and forth like a metronome. You know, you know what I'm talking. You've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he was just hilarious.
I remember one time there was a bar brawl And chairs were flying, and there was a lot of people involved, and it was kind of scary. And so we quit playing, and we went back in the kitchen there where all that action was happening on the floor, and he found a big strainer, big metal strainer, and he put it on his head like a helmet. and it was the funniest thing I ever saw, but everything was flying out there, and he had this big strainer on, and, oh, man, things like that.
He wasn't really afraid of people, though, because I can remember being afraid for him a few times where he would stand up to people that were bigger than him, and he'd kind of say just whatever he thought. And I thought, oh, boy, is this person going to punch him or or something? And I'd be afraid for him. But he just stood up to people and stand up for what he believed. And he wasn't afraid of anything.
No, he'd stand up for himself. Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah, there's probably a million other stories that I could tell, but here's one. We'd get to a club or something, and there'd be like, we'd drive 100 miles to play to nobody. And then, of course, he'd get cranky because, you know, why wouldn't you? And he'd go over the microphone. He'd say, "Doug." And I'd say, "Yeah." And he'd say, "I shaved my back for this." You know, so he would always do that, you know, so everyone could hear, "I shaved my back for this." You know. Oh, I never got old.
That's funny.
Yeah. I think that he was always first in mind for because he was so willing to play and available. And you know, he didn't need to really, you know, have rehearsals like crazy. He'd just sit right in and keep time with whatever what was going on. So
the genre he likes was hard rock, and it was rock and roll.
Yep.
And if you got into those other areas of country, whatever, he could do it, but it was pretty much the same beat that he was playing in the other. So it didn't always fit. But
right.
And he knew that. You know, he didn't, he kind of avoided those situations.
Did he have a drummer that he considered an influence or a favorite or something?
He had lots of them. Lots of them. More names that I could ever come up with, starting with, of course, Ringo Starr, you know, and Bunny Carlos, and, of course, that he followed the Vinnie Caliutas and those guys, too, and the Jeff Beccaro, I think his name was, from Toto, and he liked that technical drumming also. They play out of the box.
It's the same thing with every musician. I mean, if you're a guitar player, everybody you hear is your influence. Everybody you listen to. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with him. Every drummer that he ever heard has some influence on him, negative or positive. But
I think Fish is, when I think about his favorite drummer, I know who it is. It was Buddy Rich.
Good choice.
That was his favorite drummer.
He's excellent.
Yep.
Well, Buddy's kind of widely regarded as king.
And he's met many of them. Many, you know, Ed Shaughnessy, he met him, went to his clinic from the Tonight Show.
Really?
And
I didn't know that.
He's met a ton of those guys. And
he was a crazy guy, but for some reason, he always treated me with the utmost respect. Well, again, of course, I treated him the same way, but maybe I just got back what I dished out, so.
He really liked you, Dave. Mm-hmm. We did play with your son for way back. I think it was in the 70s. And I remember, I have a picture. Somebody sent a picture, and it was Kurt and Fish, myself, and Tony Price.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. I'll try to find that for you. I don't know where we were. We were playing somewhere. It might have been the Duluth Town Hall or something. Long, long time ago.
I think I remember that. Wasn't I playing another band at the same time?
I don't know.
I mean, there were two bands there, and I was playing.
Oh, yeah, there was another one of those, too. Kurt might have been playing there, too. Yeah, there might have been. Yeah. Yes, there was more than one band. But the one at the Luton Hall thing, I think that was in my memory anyway, it was just us. I think we only knew about 5 songs. Playing them over and over again.
It was pretty common in those days. Of course, the crowd was all jacked up. They didn't didn't know about the replay. Now I'm playing nursing homes and funerals. Think about it. Yeah. Still at it, but things are changing. You know, the crowd's changing. Everybody's having the medication adjusted. Here comes the band.
Got a... You're talking about, you know, timing your drugs for the main act, and, you know, they were, you know, hitting the geritol or whatever for you.
Yeah. A little fist pumping at the end, you know. It's just
One thing that always amazed me was how many people knew him. It was just crazy. Even from Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, you know, anywhere. If you were with Birds of a Feather and you just, you know, and you didn't know these people, but if you just mentioned Fish, they'd, one of them would go, ah, I know him, you know. It was amazing. Even down in the cities, you know, if the band's down there, they knew who he was. Everyone knew who he was. And, yeah, he got himself around, that's for sure. Yeah, he's a total legend.
I think from what I understand, there's going to be, of course, a celebration of life at 3 o'clock at the Legion. And there's going to be speakers and music that Kurt has picked out himself. And,
Excuse me, did he pick it out for the funeral? Or
he
for
did.
This service, actually?
He did. He picked out the
man,
songs.
That's cool.
For his
you, yeah, you're arranging your he own. I know people that do that. But.
He loved music, and he had beautiful music that he wanted played. I know there's one song in particular he wanted played for his, in respect to his mother. I think it was Bridge Over Troubled Water for her. Then after that, there's going to be a dinner provided by Judy's.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
They're
good.
Doing the dinner. And I believe there's going to be music that he picked out during that time. I know one of them is Elton John's album.
I think it's Madman Across the Water and some Frank Zappa, I think, and or at least Watermelon and Easter Hay. I remember he did tell me he wanted that one played. And
then after everything is done, then I believe there's going to be some other musicians that are going to have a concert for Fish. Some gatherings with that, with people playing at the Legion also. I think that's around 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you listen to the Beat Farm? I have Kurt Anderson with me. Curtis Anderson from Knife River. He lives in Two Harbors. He's been here for 100 years, but he is, nickname is Fishy. I think Fish, did you get that from just from being from Knife River? That's what they called you for that?
No, it's a long story.
Is it a nasty one? Or
that's
so?
A whole different show.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought it was because, you know, they used to say that if you're from Knife River, you smell like fish, all that kind of thing.
Oh, geez, that's very, very nice.
Well, that's where I grew up. I got the same thing.
Yeah.
Sure. I knew your father. Your father was older than me before you were born, and I was just a kid. I was in my room. We started the first band I was in, which was Dave and the Wharf Rats. And your dad would come by with his beautiful Fender guitar, which you have now.
Yes,
right?
It was 58 Strat. Yeah,
58 Strat. Yeah, mm-hmm. And he'd be rocking it up. I still Tennessee Flat Top Box was his favorite song.
Oh yeah,
cool. But. Okay, well, this thing is all about rhythm. It's all about the beat form. It's about drums, and you're a drummer, and you're the first drummer on the show.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
You've been playing how long since you?
I started lessons when I was 14, but living in Knife River with my mom and my dad, and there was music in the house, and I tried to play guitar when I was like 11 or 12, and 13 I tried bass. It didn't stick, but there was just so much music in my house with my mom, Pavarotti, and Paul Simon, and all this, and my dad had all the Sun records, and then my older brothers were bringing home, when I was getting older, Black Sabbath, and Deep Purple was big for me, you know, the Beatles, of course, and, you know, the Monkees when we were kids, but, and so we had music in the house like crazy, and then At about 14, I just thought, I talked to my mom, and she was a huge influence on my life, of course. And she just said, well, let's check out drum lessons. So went to Schmidt Music of all places and met Scott Junkert and just went crazy after that. But I do have a story before that.
What's that?
Well, when I met you guys, I was about 11, 12 years old down in Helen's campground, and you and your son McGurdy Curdy were playing guitar together down in Knife River, and I was just stunned. I think the only other person I've seen play guitar besides my dad was you guys and Jimmy Madison playing banjo in Knife River. So I was just blown away. And then maybe like a half year later, there I was in Two Harbors at Curdy's house, and I played your drums for the first time. I never hit drums in my life. And I went behind your kit, and I was just, you know, I was just a crazy kid. I couldn't believe it. My heart nearly stopped. It was changed my life. And then, you know, years later, it comes out to see that you still own that kit. And but that was the very first drums I ever played on.
They're actually your kit. That's the beauty of it.
We need to figure that out.
Yeah, yeah. We actually did a trade for some equipment years ago.
It's taken a while.
Yeah. And I still got the drums, and I haven't touched them since we made the deal there.
Beautiful Slingerland kit from way back.
Yeah, you've seen them more than once. They're a nice kit.
Yes, indeed.
So when you, I was there the first time you played in public. You played at Hugo's Bar, which kind of turned into a disaster.
Well,
not the music part of it. The music part, it was great. But
I was kind of hoping you wouldn't bring that one
up. Okay, well, let's skip right to the next thing.
That's for another show, too.
Yeah, there's a whole show there.
There's a whole show there.
What? Then I remember you went to Minneapolis. You were playing in some bands. Some of them with words that we can't say on the air.
Yeah, and yes, I can't. My mother, she came to one of our shows, and she told everybody at work when she was working down at Shakopee there at the casino. She told everybody the name of my band, and they all went, "What?" So we had to have it abbreviated in City Pages, but. It was a good band, bunch of crazy players. If I could go back real quick to like Scott Junkert, though, when I first met him when I was 14, he was a renaissance guy. I mean, he's just a great musician, and I got so lucky to be able to take lessons from a guy. He is a tin player, marimba vibes, and now he's playing piano and harmonica. The guy's a music teacher. The guy's just incredible. And the cool thing about him was we'd go to instead of taking a lesson and learning a triplet or a flammacue on the snare drum, which we did too, he'd take us down to see Buddy Rich. You know, he'd ask my mom, "Hey, borrow him $30. We're gonna go see Buddy Rich in the Hibbing High School auditorium." And that's the kind of teacher he was. And he took us to our first Frank Zappa show in the early '80s, which was just mind blowing. I mean, those are another shows too that I could talk about forever. Hopefully, if we get this drum program off the. Get that thing happening later on. Me and Mel are talking about putting together a program for this radio station about drums and influences and things like that too. And that's a whole nother show too.
I wish somebody would have come and got me to see Buddy Rich.
Yeah, well, I was 14 years old and I was 15 and I was getting okay on the drums and I thought I was kind of groovy, you know, Knife River, Minnesota. And then I seen Buddy Rich and then I was like, well, it's time to quit. But I kept going on after that. But Buddy was the greatest.
Before you got your first set of drums and took lessons, what did you do? Like, did you beat on the table?
And, I had a hamper and a couple of ice cream pails, and I didn't even dare tell Scott, my drum teacher, for the first 2 months that I didn't have a drum set. And then he found out, and he's like, "We got to get you some drums."
So. Okay, well, we got another parallel there because I used to go over to Congdon's store and go through his garbage and get the ice cream pails out of there.
Exactly.
The cartons, and then I would go cut down popple trees for sticks. The little short ones. Uh-huh. And I'd be rat-a-tatting on those and I'd stuff things in them or put some sand in the bottom so one would sound different than the other so they weren't identical.
Right, so they change in pitch.
Yeah, so different toms.
You know? You were a little more creative than me. I just banged on whatever the hell I had. I'm sorry. And then what happened was that when I first got some real drums, then the life just changed and then everything was just like, wow, just crazy.
Well, you play. I see you playing with everybody in town. You played with the guest was on last week was Mel Sando, and you play with him all the time.
Well, on and off we do. Yeah. As a matter of fact, in 2012 we got to play the Blues Festival in Duluth, Bayfront, and we played on the acoustic stage, and it was really cool. We really took it serious, and we rehearsed for like 3 weeks straight, and it was great for me and him who grew up together. I could talk about Mel forever too. And we've been, since we were in high school, we were talking about Ted Nugent and all this stuff. And we were just, you know, so we were, we've always been into that. And, but it was great to finally get together with him, you know, later on in life. And I got to play a big show with him, and it was a huge success. We had a lot of fun. It was really great.
You, I've had Derek Heidel on. I see you play with him.
Mm-hmm.
I've had,
yes, he's great.
Phil Ness. I've seen you play with him. And you play with everybody in town. I see you. You know, every band I see, there's Fishy sitting in the back hammering away.
Well, and, you know, I was going to say, in this small area we live, we always had a bunch of musicians here. I mean, even when I was a kid, it was your son on bass, Curtie. It was Mike Selman on guitar, Doug Lindahl on guitar, Tony Price on guitar, and I was on drums. I mean, and of course, Doug Lindahl, who's, you know, me and him have been playing together forever. So I had to do a shout out about Doug, and we've done some really crazy good things. And we're still recording our record, which has taken about 5 years, but
no hurry.
Still, you're right. Well, it's just the three of us, me and Doug and Carl Neer, and Carl owns the studio. So we got all the time in the world, but we better get finished soon.
Well, you know, gigs are tough to come by unless you're a huge, huge star. But you got this other thing going on where you've got all these sets of drums. Every time I talk to you, you say, well, I got a set of drums on the road right now with B.B. Yep. King or somebody like that. You know, those kinds of artists that are just huge.
Well, it was pretty crazy about maybe 6-7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, Travis Johnson was T&E Concert, and he's in the same warehouse as Sound Central with Trent Edgerton, who was also a student of Scott's when I was a kid. He's a great guy. These guys are all great. And he came to my house. He said, hey, you got some drum sets. You want to rent them? And at the time, I didn't know what backline meant. I did not know that bands fly in and they have nothing. BB comes in with his Lucille, and that's it. And we got to get him lab amps. We got to get B3s with, you know, the cabinets, and we got to have full drums. And so, sure enough, I said, sure. And about 3 weeks later, we did 4 shows with B.B. King. And then I think the first one was Springfield, Missouri. And for me, to be a drum tech and not to be out front was just about as crazy, as exciting as being in front. I mean, I really, really enjoyed it. It's a pretty cool thing to do. And I've always been working on drums and playing drums, so it was really easy for me to be a tech because I've been, you know, I grew up with a drum set. So
you've got how many sets have you got out there now that are around?
I think at the warehouse we have maybe 7 or 8, and then I think Travis has like maybe 4 or 5, and just a cache of hardware and cymbals, and just, you know, because every time you deal with an artist, you have to actually, they give you a rider. They need Zildjian Ks, or they need Sabian whatever AAs.
Right.
I know this is probably language that a lot of people don't know what I'm talking about, but
they're classy cymbals.
All the drums have to be world class. I mean, some of the stuff we pay, you know, like $1,600 for a kick drum, just because that's what they need, and you know, and after a while it builds up, and you find yourself with a warehouse full of stuff.
Yeah, you know, every professional drummer I know, when you say how many drums do you have, they maybe have one or two what they would call sets, but in about 15 minutes they can pull together another 2 or 3 sets from just pieces that they got laying around.
Right.
So.
Well, and there's a few kits that I don't let go out. The Steve Gadd kit that I bought about 8 years ago, it's one of like 50 made from Yamaha. Gadd's the original from, he wrote the lick for 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. He was with Paul Simon forever, and he's played with everybody in the world. If you go on stevegadd.com and look up his discography, it runs for sheets and sheets of the people, Steely Dan and all those guys. So he's probably my favorite drummer. And when Yamaha came out with that kit, I said, man, I gotta have that. It was not cheap. I'm still probably paying for it, but
I played a Steve Gadd song on my last show when Mel was on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm
cool.
Familiar with him.
Cool.
So what are you doing now? Are you playing anywhere? I mean, it's tough to do. Nobody's hiring bands anymore, but I know if there is a gig around, you're in it.
Well, what happened was I was with Heitala and Phil Ness, Derek Heitala and Phil Ness and Jim, and we were in a band called the Cervantes, and we kind of took ourselves off the road in other bands I was in because, you know, a lot of you have kids and family and all this. And, you know, we're getting older, so. And we were banging around and great players, man. But things dried up a bit. So I was kind of just, you know, jamming with you guys and jamming with Mel a little bit and playing acoustic stuff, brushes and piccolo snares and stuff. And then Jim was in a band called Raging Country. And they were a great band. They're playing the hard new country stuff, you know, the Luke Bryan and all that stuff. And then Amanda Lambert, they're pretty much a rock and roll band playing country. Great, great musicians. If I can list them out real quick. Otis lead vocals. He runs the whole show. Lindsay, beautiful girl, sings like a million bucks. Jim Holbeck on guitar and John on bass. Great bass player, man. These guys are great. Work ethic, real strong. I had only been in the band, I think, only about 4 months now, but I mean, they were ready to roll. They were looking for a drummer. I tried out and I got the gig, and before I knew it, we're in Sturgis. We played Sturgis for 2 nights, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, well, I knew that Jim was out there. I talked to talked to his dad. I was playing with his dad, actually, in Duluth. His dad's a bass player.
Right.
And he says, my son's in Sturgis right now playing.
Yeah. And I was only in a band for like 2 months. And it was like pretty crazy. You know, it was a 75th anniversary. And, you know, it was just a sea of humanity. And but we played real good. I hit a hailstorm on Monday. But we were right downtown, too. We were in one of the campgrounds. We actually played right next to the Easy Rider. It was a place called the Side Hack. Cool place. And when we were down there, man, it was only 75 degrees. I couldn't believe it.
That's right. And usually it's over 100.
Now. Oh, I know. When we were leaving on Wednesday, it was getting up to hundreds. I mean, we got to get out of here. But
where did you stay there? It's tough to find a room.
Well, right. Well, we brought down a couple of pop-out campers, or one of them, and then a tent. And we actually had a generator for we were actually in the Iron Horse Campground, which was about 3 miles out of Sturgis, which is about 6 hours to get in.
Right.
Nobody was moving.
Yeah, it's a lot of traffic in there.
Never been out there before for that.
Okay, what do you got lined up? You got anything going on for the future? Where are you going to be playing? Where can somebody come and see you play?
First of all, I wanted to say, if you want to look up Raging Country on Facebook, I think we have a website too, but it's RAGE-N and then country, and you'll find us right away, or you can find out where we're playing, what kind of shows we're doing, what we have done. There's some streaming video on there, which is pretty cool. Tomorrow night, we're at Mr. D's. Believe it or not, I haven't played that club in 20 years. And here's something funny. We're going to be doing the Christmas City of the North Parade. We're actually going to be on a float playing some Christmas stuff. So it'll be kind of fun. You know, rumor has it I might be in a Santa suit, but I'm not too sure.
I'm glad I'm not playing guitar on that one. I hate to play it. When my fingers are cold, I can't play.
Well, it's so. You know, it's going to be 10 degrees. I feel for the guitar players, but it should be a lot of fun.
Well, I tell you what, I really appreciate you coming in. Like I said, you're the first drummer on the show, and percussion. I build you as a percussionist, not just a drummer, a percussionist. Because I've seen you play. You know, you show up with a set of congas and a snare, and switch back and forth, and it works. I've seen you play congas with rock stuff, and it works.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was really fun to play that stuff with Heitel and Phil Ness, because Phil's got a book full of 300 songs, and he just flips open the book and starts rolling, and I just sit behind him. It's kind of fun.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks again, Fishy.
Thanks
for coming in.
You betcha.
On the air, this is Dave Anderson. This is Big Dave's Beat Farm, KTWH 99.5 LP, Two Harbors Community Radio. I'm in the studio. And in seniority order, I've got Fishy here, sitting here, which is Kurt Anderson, Bill Turnquist, and Mel Sando.
Early in the morning,
it's early in the morning, baby.
early in the morning.
I said it's early in the morning, and I got me nothing but these blues.
A celebration of life will be held tomorrow, Saturday, January 11th, 2025, at the American Legion in Two Harbors at 3 p.m., followed by a night filled with music and friends.